Good morning, Wake Up HEC, Cris Oviedo with you. I am going to start by saying, if you haven't had a chance to watch and listen the series, the social sciences series that happened back in March, you can still go check them out. Go to howardcc.edu. On the search bar, my best friend, just type on their social sciences series. And you know, you have about six videos there. Where you want to click on each one of them, maybe make it a 6-day type of deal so you don't watch all of them. Or maybe if you love, you know, criminal justice and those kind of topics, just watch all of them. You will be sorry if you miss that opportunity. This is thought-provoking conversations, and that's why we're here this morning. We are here because these are important topics, and there are so many things and so many ways, and I personally felt like, oh my gosh, I only get an hour to try and have this conversation with my two guests this morning. And it's, I have Evelyn Del Rosario. She's the Academic Coordinator of Criminal Justice here at Howard Community College. And Dr. Eric Clark, he is an Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice here at HEC. And I want to welcome you both this morning and thank you for joining me. We're going to dive into some deep questions. We're going to explore some topics. But first, we're going to get to know each one of you a little bit, just a little bit better. So Dr. Clark, let's start with you. And if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and what inspired you to pursue a career in law enforcement and become a criminal justice teacher. Welcome and good morning.
I'm Dr. Eric Clark. And I think what you should know about me, first of all, is that I'm a committed educator. I'm a family man. I'm a student. I believe I'm a student of life. I'm local in the community. I was operational as a federal law enforcement officer, and now I'm in academia. And I'm committed to the betterment of our community. I'd say that. So everything that I do, life and professional life, is pretty much geared to making everything around me a little bit better and making those who are around me more happier to the best of my ability. I believe what inspired me is that essentially as a youngster growing up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is that the area I grew up in, either you were police or you were in the medical field or you were a gangster. And I came from a family of professionals and a family of gangsters. And I decided to make a decision early in my life that I didn't want to be a gangster, and I wanted to be a professional. I got my bachelor's degree in accounting from here at Morgan State University, and I actually went back to Pittsburgh, and I was a staff accountant for about a year and a half, and my feet started to drag, and one of my aunts got me into security work, and from then on, I kind of found my niche from doing private security, a special police officer, a certified police officer, and then I eventually went into law enforcement full time. So I'd say that my progression and my matriculation into law enforcement was just as a result of me wanting to know more about the field, me wanting to have greater opportunities to do more for myself, and really to be on a quest for knowledge and trying to go to the highest levels of law enforcement that I possibly could to learn more and to do more. And it turned out to be a great career in which I retired from the United States Marshal Service. I'm retired in good standing, and I retired, and I'm here now teaching full time.
What a journey. And you know, that choice, right? That choice that you made that defined the rest of your life and how it was going to go. It's a choice that I know many of our students, many of our youth are faced with today. You know, it's a reality that everybody faces on a daily basis. We always have that choice. We always have the choice of making the right or the wrong decision. And what we decide to do with that can certainly define and take us in paths that we may or may not want to be involved. That could be a whole nother conversation, but, yes. You know, just thank you for acknowledging that. Thank you for empowering just right there in that sense, in that conversation, saying you have that choice. Many times we feel like we don't have the choice, but we do. We have that choice. Evelyn, let's hear from you. Let's get to know you a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your background. I'm very curious about, you know, your female perspective, because law enforcement, female. I know that TV is at least trying to break that stereotype. But I want to hear, you know, real life. What does that mean? What has that been for you? What has been the most rewarding thing for your career, the thing that you enjoy the most? And good morning and welcome.
So let me start a little with my background. So I have a doctorate degree from law school. I am a doctor. And I think as a woman, I say this because it's important to acknowledge a woman's title, right? Especially as a woman of color, it is important to speak up, right, to one's power and acknowledge that, because it was quite a feat given where I come from. So I am, and I always say this, and I say this proudly, I am the daughter of immigrants. I am a first generation American. And for my family, having a child get a higher degree, get a law degree, be a doctor, was something of great accomplishment. And I did it realizing that it is vital to have the voice of minority women to be heard, right? So that's how I started. I practiced immigration law, and I did some criminal, some civil. And I always say, and I say this in my classrooms, I enjoyed it, right? But I love teaching. And I love teaching criminal justice. And I tell my students that if they get nothing else from my classrooms, they will get an appreciation of the law, right? Because it is complex. It is not applied equally at times, many times, let's be realistic. But the beautiful thing about the law is that it strives to be equitable, right? I always tell my students, it strives for perfection. But we examine the different ways in which it falls short. I've been teaching for going on my 12th year. I've been the coordinator of the program about 5 years now. And as I said, I love teaching. I love teaching of the law, and I love to see my students, get that appreciation and then pursue their own careers. And as I tell them, go and make it better. So.
Thank you for clarifying that. And thank you for correcting me because, you know, as I said, we didn't have that opportunity before we went live, and I've been addressing you by your first name, but absolutely, you are a powerful woman, Dr. Del Rosario. It's from here on how I'm going to address you in our conversation, because yes, absolutely. You've done the work, and yes, we need to elevate women. And that's why I ask you that question, because I know that, personally, as being a woman as well, it's hard. It's a little hard for us to break those barriers and to get to those levels and to get that respect and that recognition. So by all means, Dr. Del Rosario, thank you for being here with me. Dr. Clark, let's go back with you and let's just clarify, criminal justice, that's a broad term. And maybe somebody's listening, somebody's watching and is saying, I know that I want to do something that involves the law and justice, but I'm not sure exactly where to go and what to do. So when we talk about criminal justice and when we say that we offer that degree here at HEC, what exactly are we talking about?
When we say we're talking about criminal justice is considered to be the study of the three areas of social control. And those three areas are police, courts, and corrections. And essentially, when we go into criminal justice, there's a definitive 13 steps that everything within the criminal justice system occurs in. And that begins with investigation and through release from prison. So there's definitive steps that you go through from the time you encounter the police to the time you go into the court system, to the time you get incarcerated if you go to jail. So that's just a broad overview, but it covers those fields and it covers police, courts, and corrections. But there's so many different things within those three different fields. And the biggest thing is that those are three areas of social control, because the essence of criminal justice, from my perspective, is to try to control deviant and criminal behaviors, and specifically criminal behaviors. And having a knowledge of those things in place for everyday citizens, it provides a certain amount of control. We see a speed camera, and it may be on one day. The next day we go down the street, it may not be on, but we slow down, and that's a form of social control. Although no one is on the speed camera, that's the form of what the police have done, is to keep you out of the court system, and hopefully you don't go into the correctional system. So those are forms of social control, and criminal justice covers those areas of police, courts, and corrections. That's a broad overview of it.
Dr. Del Rosario, control in, you know, our community and changes, and we continue to evolve, right? We continue to change issues that, you know, I mean, Dr. Clark just gave us a perfect example. Maybe there wasn't a camera, a speed camera there, and now there is. It shift. And that's a small example, right? We have social issues. We have, I mean, other bigger issues at heart here that we can talk about. As we continue to evolve in community, how does criminal justice evolve and change to reflect those changes?
That's a very good question. Well, that's just part of, you know, the nature of our legal system, right? If you look at the Constitution itself, while there is a lengthy process in changing the Constitution, it is feasible. There is an acknowledgement that as citizens, we can get involved, right? We can create social change. How does that happen, right? Well, I tell my students, just one, becoming aware. One thing that I like to empower my students with is knowledge of what, you know, our rights are as citizens. And as citizens, I mean, as, you know, people that are in this country, what our rights are, because there's something extremely powerful about being that, about knowing that. And it is once you know, one, like what your rights are, what the law says, how the system works, you can go in and find the different methods that are in place to affect, in essence, change. And Dr. Clark can speak to this. A lot of our students are interested in law enforcement, and it's so wonderful to have someone on faculty with that level of expertise. Many of our students are interested in pursuing law degrees or something, you know, in the judicial system. Well, how wonderful to have myself that I can guide them through that process. And it is once this young generation is there with the knowledge, with the understanding, once they're there, they can essentially affect the change that our criminal justice system, and I stress, you know, what I said earlier, although it strives for justice and equity, it fails so many times. So we need young people that are passionate about affecting social change.
Social change, right? Affecting social change. And we've witnessed in the last few years, there's a loud cry for changing the system, for justice, for fairness, right? That's what we hear. That's the message that we hear. Dr. Clark, when you started your presentation that you did back in March, one of the first things that you said is you clarified and you said, I am pro law enforcement and I'm also pro citizen. Yes. And I think that the discourse right now is that you can be either or, but you can be both. And here we have a criminal justice professor at HCC saying, I'm both. I am pro citizen and I'm pro law enforcement. Please help us understand how to be both, right? And what it means to be both.
Thank you. Great question. I think, first of all, being both is equally, it's inspiring because you can be both, but it's a challenge. And when I came out and I made that statement is that oftentimes when persons who are in academia, when they come and they speak about things dealing with law enforcement specifically, and specifically use of force, It's normally from the perspective of someone who has not been in that position, someone who hasn't gotten hit, someone who hasn't been in use of force incidents. And so you lose a lot of the law enforcement or those who support law enforcement when you come on as an academic, because the first thing that someone thinks is that, well, you haven't been in that situation. So what I clarified was I am pro-law enforcement and that I support our law enforcement. I retired as a law enforcement officer, but also I'm pro-citizen because the things that are happening in which there are abuses of power, I'm still in that category. Although I'm a doctor and I'm here with you all, I am on the streets here, I'm still in this high-risk category. And not that I'm engaging in high-risk activities, but based on implicit bias and based on other socioeconomic factors, based on how the officer is feeling that day, I'm still there. So I wanted to come across to say, hey, that I live in both of these worlds and I can give you some things that I've done and I've given you some things that I feel. So yeah, I support our law enforcement agencies and I support our law enforcement personnel 110%. At the same time, I'm also a civilian and that some of the things that we're doing are wrong. But I said that from a perspective in which I've been in those scenarios and I can tell when something is right or something's wrong, either having had been in it or having had happened to me. So I just wanted to make that clear. And that way I tried to capture everybody in the audience. I didn't want to lose anybody. I didn't want to lose those who are proponents or advocates of the police. I didn't want to lose anybody. So I had to make that statement from the door and say, here I am. Let me tell you what I think. And you take the best out of it. And that's what's not good for you. You let it go.
And, you know, I really appreciate that because that's, I think, the challenge that we have right now as a country, really, is like we are dividing right there, right in that line where you just said, I'm either a citizen or I'm either pro law enforcement. And that divide needs to stop. We need to, you know, we need perspectives like yours where you can help us bridge that that gap that's forming there so we can come together and stop, you know, just looking at the other as the evil, right? As the one that's wrong and move forward because I am with you. I feel the same way. It's like, and you know, Dr. Del Rosario, you talked about this with the Fourth Amendment, right? In the talk that you did, you said that it's there for two reasons. One, to protect us as citizens, but also to stop that abuse and kind of like keep the police in check, right? And within their limits, make sure that they are not abusing that force. Tell us a little more about the Fourth Amendment and how it does that, how it protects us regular citizens, but at the same time keeps police accountable in their work.
That's a very good question. Well, as I hope that I illustrated and explained during our talk back in March, it's the language of the amendment itself, right? It says unreasonable searches, right, are essentially prohibited, right? So, you know, it's kind of, again, going back to teaching what that means, right? Because it's a short amendment, like most of, you know, the amendment, especially those in the Bill of Rights, they tend to be short. But what does it mean, right? It means that they cannot, the police, the government cannot intrude on privacy, right? We have this right to ourself, to our body, to our possessions, and the government cannot intrude upon it without this thing, right, noted in the Fourth Amendment that is called probable cause. Well, if a person doesn't know what probable cause is, right, they won't have an understanding. They won't have the knowledge. And we know knowledge is power, right? So there needs to be understanding of what is probable cause, right? And this is not explained in the Constitution. One thing I say a lot in my class is that, you know, the Constitution does not provide footnotes or endnotes, right? And right, it would be great. Like, I don't know what the founders were thinking, but the meaning, right, of these like amendments, these short amendments have been given to us by the Supreme Court in their infinite, sometimes not so infinite, but based on their knowledge. So, you know, they said, well, probable cause is having having something tangible, having evidence, right? And they went on and made a distinction between that and something else called reasonable suspicion. There's an understanding that for law enforcement to function well, you know, we can't strip them of all the power. And I don't think if a private citizen thinks logically, they would want that, right? When we are in trouble, who's the first, you know, who are we going to call? Not Ghostbusters. No. We're going to call 911, right? We need the police, right? We need to work with them. But the police are a very powerful entity, right? And, you know, there's a realization that they have a lot of power. So the Fourth Amendment, the Supreme Court, by extension, has kind of trying to buffer us against the immense power that the police have, right? So it says, you know, they need tangible evidence, but hey, they have to do their work. So sometimes if they have reasonable suspicion, that's nowhere in the Constitution, nowhere in the Fourth Amendment, nowhere in the Constitution, this notion of reasonable suspicion. And I try to illustrate that in my talk back in March as to what that means, right? There's times when the police, they are almost certain that you're up to no good, but they don't have, you know, that smoking gun. Can they still stop you? And if they can, what can they do, right? And if you are the one that's being stopped, and if you're the one that's being searched or frisked, what are your rights, right? Because it could feel like these two entities are working against one another. But again, if we have the knowledge, right, it doesn't have to work against, you know, the police. It can actually work to give us a voice and work more cooperatively with the police.
And I think that's crucial for both ends, right? To really be very mindful, understand where the limits are, where my rights start, where your limits end. And I think that's, it's as you were saying, you try to illustrate that through, and you did beautiful through your presentation. It's very clear. And again, I encourage everybody to go and watch and learn like I did, you know, through this presentation, because it can be a gray area. You know, one of your examples was the police is running and they smell something. And I wonder about that before. And you talked about this cloud that, you know, I mean, we've seen come out through cars as we've been driving, and I've wondered, could the police come and stop them just because they're seeing that? And if you watch the presentation that Dr. Del Rosario did, you'll get your answers. You'll get your answers about that. It's important to be informed about that. But Dr. Clark, you talked about de-escalation techniques, and you know, you already took us a step farther, right? What if you are apprehended? What if you're already in custody? Because we have seen how quickly the situations can escalate and how they can be fatal if they get out of hand. Let's talk about the importance, the urgency, the need for this de-escalation techniques, what the goal is for them, the ones that you've come up with. And, you know, there's unfair questions, and there's this one case that I know we're all thinking about right now. And one question that came to me as I was watching the news reports, and as I continue to follow, this case of this couple, where apparently, you know, they found a body now. And, you know, again, I don't want to talk about it because it's still under investigation, even though it's covered throughout the entire media. But in my mind, after watching your presentation, Dr. Clark, I was like, what kind of techniques could these police officers have had at their hand? You know, what kind of training could they have had that maybe could have prevented this not yet solidified death, right? This probable death of this young lady. How could techniques like de-escalation techniques could have prevented the deaths of the George Floyds of the world? So help us understand what that training, what that de-escalation technique looks and feels like, and the importance of really starting changing the way our police navigates the situations with us on a daily basis.
Oh, definitely. I'm not too up to speed on the case that you were just referring back that's currently in the news. Of course, with George Floyd, we've all covered that and we researched and analyzed it. Essentially, de-escalation techniques or decompression techniques is a specific set of guidelines that's going to reduce the intensity of a conflict or a potentially dangerous situation. It's a way in which officers or people in any type of field in which you're dealing with emergent issues, police, nurses, any type of industry or institution where there's something that's happening right now and there's an underlying issue concerning the crisis that the person is in. So the techniques that I developed came about through my time at the Marshals Service, where I was involved. I was in a very dynamic, volatile, and violent closed custody environment. I was, and it's not a badge and honor, I was involved in an excessive amount of use of force techniques where people often got hurt. I was never accused of an abuse of power, but any type of control technique or defensive tactics technique, the premise of it is pain compliance, in which people get hurt to bring them into custody or to have them do what you want them to do. As I move forward in my career, I realized that, okay, I'm doing this right. I've done everything right. However, the application of the techniques, someone is getting hurt. So I developed these techniques essentially for myself to keep me out of trouble, but also some of my staff used them. And the essence of any de-escalation technique anywhere in the world is to slow the scenario down, slow the intensity down of the scenario so that the person who could be the subject of the use of force, we allow them to think, listen, I want to help you help me. So I'm going to take a step back, either physically or emotionally. I'm going to take a step back and allow you to think about what's going on. I want to offer you the least, if possible, the least intrusive way to resolve this scenario, but you have to help me. I'm allowing you to help you direct where this dynamic is going to go. And I think that's what we need. And a lot of different things that we've seen have not been, especially with George Floyd, it wasn't a use of force scenario in which killed him. It was an in custody scenario. And the biggest thing is that this happens every day in police encounters where someone is in custody, so they're physically restrained, but they're not compliant. And so they're moving and they're still fighting. And that's the gap. That's that gap in that area where officers will go, okay, the training tells me that when you're in cuffs, you're supposed to give up. However, folks aren't giving up. So I can't use any more force because you're already restrained. However, you are still not complying as to the follow through after the arrest. So what these techniques, specifically mine, help do is identify the real issue, the underlying issue. And hey, let's try to help with the issue. The example with George Floyd is that he did not want to get into the vehicle. He said he was claustrophobic. He was having some problems with getting into the vehicle. He was already restrained, but because the officers didn't pick up on what he was saying, they didn't fully acknowledge what he was saying from my perspective. They didn't understand. He's not trying to stop us from arresting him. He's not fighting. He doesn't want to get into the vehicle. So either you develop some new techniques in which you can forcefully put somebody into a vehicle, or you wait it out a little bit and you move forward with another mode of transportation. And that's the de-escalation part. It wasn't that he wanted to fight. He didn't want to get into the vehicle. And so the essence of my techniques are premised on that, is that let's deal with the underlying issue. And hopefully if we can address the underlying issue and allow the person in custody or the target of the use of force, we can allow them to help themselves, you might have a better outcome, because we talked about power, right? Dr. Del Rosario talked about empowering women. Well, even in that scenario, although the police officer is in charge, you're still allowing the person to help empower themselves in this scenario. And it means a lot. It's really significant that they are allowed to help themselves, even though in custody, I want you to help yourself, or I want you to help yourself so this doesn't get any worse. But you have to stand firm on what you do, and the officers have to train continuously, and citizens have to know this. You know, this is the EASE techniques are both helpful for the police officers to not go forward in use of force. And at the same time, it's helpful for the community because they can say, hey, let's decompress and let me help you, officer, not beat on me. And so it's important for both parties to know about decompression and both parties be willing to help themselves. That's how I would answer that question to the best of my ability.
Dr. Del Rosario, you know, I'm thinking about this situation. I'm thinking about the Fourth Amendment. Somebody goes into custody, and during your talk, you said that once you're under custody, your Fourth Amendment just plunges, right? But it doesn't fully go away. So in a situation like this, right, where there's excessive force, somebody is under custody, where was that limit? Where was that Fourth Amendment? How should it have come into play, you know, when George Floyd was apprehended, and how could it have maybe solved, right? If somebody would have said, let's use the Fourth Amendment, right? And I know that that's just me being almost cartoonish here, right? In a situation that's very serious. But if we could have taken that and said, wait a minute, the Constitution here says this, right? And the Fourth Amendment here still grants him some rights. How could that have prevented? And where did we go wrong there? And where did we not apply the Fourth Amendment? And why did it escalate to the point of George Floyd's death?
That's a very good question, right? I don't know if the framers could have anticipated, right? Something like that, right? Because there's so many other issues involved. There's the race issue, right? There's so many other issues. But can we use the Fourth Amendment to prevent future cases like this? Well, you're right, you know, I did say, and I often say, you know, once you're arrested, your rights plummet, right? Not to the extent that it means that you lose your right to breathe, right? It never went that far. And although I say I don't think the framers could have anticipated, the authors of the Constitution were very wary of having a strong government, right? If you think back to the Federalist Papers and the debate of getting this Constitution ratified, there was a fear of a strong government. And I think George Floyd, his death, represented, you know, literally having the government on your neck, preventing a person from breathing. It was symbolic for so many people for that reason. But let's see if we can use the Fourth Amendment, you know, to prevent cases like this. Well, we know that, you know, it prevents unreasonable searches. And I explained in my talk that that's an intrusion, right? The government cannot just walk up to you and reach into your pockets. Your pockets are private. It prevents seizures. And I explained that a seizure is a taking of your things and it's a taking of your person, right? So in this context is the taking of his liberty, right? The arrest. So essentially, since the Fourth Amendment says that, you know, those seizures, those arrests cannot be reasonable, well, then in that context, I think it is fair to say that it was unreasonable, right? It was unreasonable. So what can be done to prevent things like this? And perhaps that just goes beyond the Fourth Amendment itself. Let's consider why George Floyd was seized, right? He was arrested for using counterfeit. Is that level of force necessary for that type of offense? Is that reasonable? You know, George Floyd was just one of a slew of unarmed, Black men who have been seized in a manner that is unreasonable for what many would consider minor crimes, right? So that's kind of the issue, I think. It's like, it goes beyond the Constitution. It goes back to training the police. It goes back to using, and that goes back to training, a different level of force. And I think Dr. Clark made an excellent point. Floyd was not resisting the arrest itself. He did not want to go into that vehicle, right? There has to be a communication. And departments have to evolve to enable that communication. Right? It's for the best interest of the police department. It creates better relationships with the community. And by extension, it's in the best interest of the community, right? Because in all honesty, would George have benefited from knowing that the police did not have a right to do that at that moment? Let's be realistic. Would he have benefit from knowing that he had rights at that moment? And I know I'm saying that there's power in being in knowledge, but sometimes there just has to be, you know, a cooperation, right? There has to be communication. And this is an example where it goes beyond the Constitution. It goes beyond, you know, the black letter of the law. It requires communication. It requires the police having better, you know, interactions with the community and vice versa. And I hope I answered your question.
No, absolutely. And, you know, thinking about that, every time we see a case like this, inevitably, mental health, criminal background are two things that come at the forefront of the conversation, right? But they come in to victimize, they come in to blame the victim many times, right? Or to excuse the actions. Dr. Clark, you might be able to give us a little bit of a better understanding, because, you know, mental health is a real thing. It's important. And the one thing that I don't think that we are talking about enough is that it actually happens on both sides, right?
Yes,
we are
yes.
using it as a way of either excusing or debilitating, maybe taking away power or victimizing somebody. We're using it almost as an excuse, right? But we're not really diving deep into mental health and one, how it affects law enforcement, right? Because there's that side of it too. Second, that it is a real thing, and that when somebody calls in a crisis, in a mental health crisis, what's the preparation? Is you know, do we go and is our law enforcement ready to go and deal with somebody who is in a mental state crisis, right? Is that the job of the law enforcement, or do we really need to start rethinking our law enforcement and creating a new, I don't know, a new wave, a new department that is prepared, better prepared to go and handle the situations? And it's a broad question, and it's, you know, it's kind of like a utopic pose really for you to kind of like give us, but because I feel that you, as you said earlier, you have been on both sides of it. You are a professor now, you were in the law enforcement. How do we manage that? How do we bring that together so that it's fair for everybody?
Excellent question. In my career, I've dealt with people who were had a full blown crisis. I knew that they had mental health issues and that they came from a hospital and they've gone into full crisis. And sometime it was violent and sometime it was not. I think the biggest thing that we have to look at is that what patrol is the basic unit of policing. Those are the people that you see every day in uniform and vehicles. And they're gonna deal with a lot of people first. I think the key issue is this an emergent issue? Does this person, we think that there's something going on with this person. However, is their behavior one that's causing a threat to safety? So the officer is in a very precarious situation because I don't want to hurt you because I think that there's something else going on and you need some help. You don't need handcuffs. You need some help. But your behavior based on what you're doing is unpredictable. And now that unpredictability presents a threat to me and or someone around me. So I think that officers in the field, there's officers now who are part of critical incident response teams, and they can respond when there are issues or scenarios where the person is not self-injurious, and or not hurting someone, but there's something going on. There's something odd about this behavior. Maybe we got a 911 call and just something's not right, but there's no law that has been broken. And so as a result of that, that's when those officers need to look at it. Now, when there are scenarios in which the person's behavior is now threatening, legitimately threatening to someone else in the public, then you have to take action. That's where it starts to slide, because the public says, you know what, you knew something was wrong and you moved on him. And then law enforcement goes, well, his behavior was threatening to others. So you should have done something. So it's a broad category. I think one of the best things that I would suggest is, number one, us in the community, we need to better help our own folks, our families who have mental health issues who are in the community. You know what I mean? If your son is not, your son or your daughter, your mother, your father is supposed to be on some medicines for something that they're on and they are not, and you know that they are outside and they are amongst the public, there's a strong chance that they can make an encounter with the police. So I think it starts at home. It starts with resources coming back into the community so that we can better help those who have mental health issues and help make them safe. In addition to that, police need to know it. That falls under like a little bit of community policing. Well, yeah, I know that Johnny has some issues. I know how he acts when he's on his meds or when he's not on his meds. And this is his normal behavior. So instead of me putting handcuffs on him, let me stop, let me talk to him. Maybe let me get someone here to help him out. But it comes with having a knowledge of the community. And it comes with having that the community members need to know that, hey, the police don't want to take you to jail first. They want to help you. So let's work together. The issue that we haven't covered a lot, which is a very emergent issue, is the mental health of our law enforcement officers. And actually, and seeing trauma, many of us have PTSD. I'm one of those ones who, based on being in a very dynamic, close custody, violent environment for years, is that I developed a set of defense mechanism skills for certain things. If you go into a room with prisoners, if you work in a closed custody environment and everything is quiet and there's 500 people in there, but there's no noise, those are your triggers. So most of us who've been in this field this long, we start putting our backs to the wall. We maybe put one foot up on the wall. We do different things because we feel that there's something there's a pending attack. And law enforcement, because the machismo involved in law enforcement, we don't reach out for help. That's number one. Number two, if you do reach out for help, there's someone who may not have been a law enforcement officer who says, you know what, Dr. Clark is a threat now. He's not stable enough to carry a badge and a gun. And so now I lose my arrest powers and I lose my weapon and I also lose my pay. So my pay is reduced from a law enforcement pay to an administrative pay. So what a lot of law enforcement officers do is that they self-medicate. They self-medicate, and that's how they deal with the trauma and the violence that they see every day. The flip side of it is that trauma and the violence that they see, it routinely goes into abuses of power against the community, because the officers are mad at the community for the violence that they see, so they take it out on the community. They go back. So it's a very big field. And that's something that some more research needs to be done concerning officers who are dealing with trauma. They face this trauma and they're out there in the forefront. So it's the same thing as, I don't want an officer who's been traumatized with violence coming to help me because I don't know where he's going to go. The same thing that he sees as someone being unpredictable, I can see that he's being unpredictable. So we need some help. This field is broad, and mental health and law enforcement and the civilian community, we're at a crux with a lot of different things. And so we need help. help is needed.
Thank you for elevating that. And thank you for bringing it back. First home, right? As you said, we can start at home taking care of each other, but then looking at the bigger issue, which is really we need to take care of everybody, right? Both sides, both citizens and law enforcement is just as important, because that can be what makes that big difference in that moment of distress. Understanding police, you know, community policing, like you said, I mean, we could talk again another hour just about that, but we are running out of time. Dr. Del Rosario, I do want to ask you, because you have taught both at the Howard County Police Department and you're teaching here at HEC. So you're teaching and you have taught both sides, right? The law enforcement side, the people who are already in there, and our students, our youth who want to go into criminal justice and want to make a change, want to make a difference. What is it that you want both sides to learn? What is it that you know, in your goal in your classes that you want them to take with them so that they apply through their careers?
We are all people. We all, at the end of the day, we all want to go home to our families. I've had students who have had bad experiences with the police say, I hate cops, right? And if you look, you know, at the encounters that they have, it is reasonable for them to, you know, feel traumatized by the police. The way I address that is reaching out to the department and having an officer that is not that much older than they are, right, come in and speak to the class. Because we're all people, right? And there's this idea that we have, and perhaps it's just, you know, something about being human, that we tend to see other groups as others, as, you know, inherently different from myself. And that's just an illusion. That is just basically not true. When I taught at the police department, one thing that was consistent, I will say almost universally consistent about the recruits, was that when asked why they wanted to be cops, almost every single one would say, I want to give back. I want to serve. I want to make, you know, our community a better place. Most police are not bad, right? They're not, right? We need them. Again, when we are in crisis, who are we going to call? We reach for 911. We need to work together. We need to work together. We need to have more dialogues. A few years ago, helped coordinate just a Q&A on campus, right? Where we had officers from the county come in and answer questions. And you know what? For many of those officers, I later found out it was uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable to answer the hard questions. It was uncomfortable to, you know, be there with a member of the community saying, I hate you. This is what you did, right? But it needs to be done. And, you know, while as community members, we have a responsibility to reach out, the police, as you know, the holders, for lack of a better term, of the power, have a duty to reach out, right? They have a duty to go into, you know, the schools and kind of answer the questions, feel uncomfortable, let the community know that they are people just like them. And, you know, many of them are not that much older than college students, right? And they are genuinely trying to do their job, right? Make the community a better place, but at the end of the day, go home, right? And that's what we all want. So a realization that we're at the end, right? We're all in this together.
That's a beautiful way to close our conversations, a beautiful challenge for everybody who's listening and watching to really, you know, heal. I mean, that's what we need. We need healing. We need to come together. We need to take the uniforms off. We need to learn to see each other as people, police are trying to do their job. And we also have our responsibilities as citizens, like Dr. Clark just said, you know, take your medicines, help your neighbor, help your family, your immediate family that lives with you. Let's reconnect. I think that that human connection can make a big difference and big impact in the way that our society continues to transform. Where can we get more information about the program here at Howard Community College? Where can we connect with you guys so that anybody who might be listening and watching who is interested in pursuing a career in criminal justice can come to HCC and start that path?
Well, you can find both myself and Dr. Clark on our HCC website. You can find us. There's a link to our email address, to our office numbers. I think I speak for both myself and Dr. Clark. We are here to answer questions. We want students that are interested in the field for sometimes personal growth. We have a lot of returning students, older students that they just think it's interesting and they want to learn a little more. And obviously we have students that are pursuing this as a career. Reach out to us. Come and, you know, take a class, see if you like it. Take our introductory class, Crim 101. That's when we talk about, you know, this criminal justice system and what it consists of. And it's a great way to see, you know, do you really like it? It's one thing to see it on TV. It's something completely different from getting it, the information from one of us. So just reach out, take a class. We are happy to have you.
Is there anything else that either one of you guys would like to add before we wrap our conversation up today?
I would just like to say that, first of all, thank you for inviting us, and definitely my thanks always goes out to my colleague and partner, Dr. Del Rosario, and how she concluded everything. And I just hope that we can move towards a better way of healing. We can move towards a better way of understanding. And let's focus on having realistic expectations of encounters, but reduce the intensity of those encounters. So the encounters that you see in socioeconomically distressed and marginalized communities have the same productive outcomes as those in focused communities. And I'll end there.
We need change. We need healing. We need to come together. We need to figure that out. And, you know, maybe like Dr. Del Rosario said, maybe taking that one class and sparking those conversations and just, you know, having that right knowledge, that might be the way that you can start. So howardcc.edu is the website where you can go and search just on the search bar, criminal justice. That will bring you all of the information that you need to know. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for joining us. Take this conversation with you. Check out the series that were filmed in March. Again, just howardcc.edu, social sciences series. It's all in there. Have these conversations. Have these conversations with your peers, with your family. But have those conversations, those uncomfortable conversations with those that you don't want to face it, but those are the ones that you need to have in them with. I hope you find love, respect, power, wherever you are. I hope that you know that you are enough and that you are valid. And we appreciate you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Until next time, I am Cris Oviedo. Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.